Welcome to the Personal Financial Planning Section podcast, delivering insights from experts on tax, retirement, estate, risk management, investment planning, and practice management, designed to help you best serve your clients and take your practice to the next level. I'm your PFP section host, Sarah Bradley. Be sure to visit us at aicpa.org/PFP and stay tuned at the end of the episode for information on how to access valuable resources. And now over to our guest.
Thank you, Sarah. This is Bob Keebler, and today we're here to talk about income tax planning techniques that work well in a volatile market. Let's jump right in. We're going to talk about three or four topics: Roth conversions, loss harvesting, and ISO and NSO exercise. So we want to think about what do all these things have in common in a volatile market. The volatility is going to give us opportunity. That's under the theory that eventually the market comes back. What can we do in the short term? One of the places to start is that we should look at doing Roth conversions. For clients who would otherwise do Roth conversions, can they catch the falling knife, so to speak, and can they convert at 85, 90 cents on the dollar? Can they get some type of discount to fair market value because of where the market is? Now, this is especially true with bank stocks and with oil stocks right now. So there's a real opportunity. And remember, the recovery on the upside is going to be sheltered from all future income tax. Now, keep in mind that we can no longer recharacterize. So that becomes a critical component of this. When you're looking at the Roth, remember you have the tax rate differential. Can I convert a lower rate than I'll be in the future, lower income tax rate? And that might be true because of the election cycle and the Democratic Party takes control, income tax rates go up. We know the routine. The use of the outside funds. Do I have outside funds to pay the taxes? Am I going to need the IRA funds for living expenses? Now, the other thing, too, is after the SECURE bill, remember, we can leave the money in the Roth IRA for 10 years after a person dies and let all that growth continue to be tax-free. Used to be a better deal with life expectancy, but it's still not too bad. The other thing to keep in mind is if you are going to have an estate tax, you're better to die with a Roth IRA than a regular IRA, mostly because of the inefficiency of the 691C deduction. Recall, that's the income tax deduction for the estate tax paid. We do want to keep in mind that when you're looking at a Roth conversion, you need to manage brackets. And that generally means if somebody's in the 22% bracket, maybe they can go up to the top of the 24, but they almost certainly cannot jump to the 32, 35, or 37% brackets. So there's a lot out there on Roth conversions. Hopefully some of these ideas will get you pointed in the right direction. Now let's pivot. Let's pivot over to capital loss harvesting. Obviously, people have been building portfolios. Those portfolios have turnover, and if they bought anything in January or February, they might have losses built in. And the goal would be for some people would be to harvest those losses, put those losses on the side kind of as a carry forward, and then replace those with something that will have a very strong correlation coefficient, meaning it will move together. I'm going to sell Ford at a loss and buy GM. I'm going to sell GM at a loss and buy Ford. That would be the strategy. The basic strategy is we can reduce or eliminate current capital gain. Obviously, you get a lower basis than what I just repurchased. But remember, you can specifically identify what tranche of stock you're selling. And that's a great thing because you might have 50 tranches of Ford if you've been reinvesting your dividends, and you'd never sell the old Ford you bought in 1980, but you certainly would sell the Ford you bought in January of 2020. That might be the approach. So we do want to remember, we also have to deal with the wash sale rules. Now, we basically understand this. This is your 30-day rule. So go back, look at the wash sale rules, and remember, they also extend to your IRA. I cannot sell something in the palm of my hand in my brokerage account and then turn around and buy it in my IRA. That's going to violate the wash sale rules. And there's a specific revenue ruling, I think it's 2008-5, that spells that out. We do want to remember the details about the wash sale rule. This is all covered under Section 1091 of the code. So under the statute, capital losses are denied to the extent that a taxpayer has acquired a substantially identical stock or securities within a period beginning 30 days before the sale and ending 30 days after the sale. And this rule can also apply to ETFs and index funds. What happens is the disallowed loss on the lost stock is then added to the basis of the stock we just acquired. And in that case, when you have that, the holding period of the lost stock is going to be carried over to the new stock. Now, if I sold Ford that I had held for 11 and a half months and I buy GM, my GM now has a holding period of 0 days on the day I start. So I am going to give up that holding period. Remember, it's always better to harvest your losses early rather than wait. There's no point in waiting on those. And we also want to remember sometimes it's more effective to harvest certain losses. For example, if you have a lot of short-term gain already, it's going to be better to harvest long-term losses and take advantage of that arbitrage. You want to use long-term losses to offset short-term gains. That's a given. On the other hand, what's very ineffective is if you have a long-term gain that would only be taxed at 20% or 23.8%, and you're using a short-term loss to offset that, that just doesn't make sense because that short-term loss is potentially worth 37 cents on the dollar. Why would you spend something that could save you 37 cents to save 20? You might be better to structure things slightly different. Now, when we really get into this, okay, when we really start looking at this, what other strategies do we have in the world of harvesting capital losses? The most common strategy is buying stock of a similar company. I'm going to sell Coca-Cola and buy Pepsi, things like that. Now, I could also double up on the lost stock, wait 31 days, and then sell my lost portfolio. That comes with it a lot of risk. Obviously, you're going to have some more exposure if you go down that path. We could double up on the lost stock and enter into a cashless collar. And then when you have that, if structured correctly, the loss is going to be pushed into the collar, and you'll get to take that. The other strategy, which is a very interesting strategy, is you buy a call option at the money. That's just like doubling up. And then what happens is you're going to be able to take that loss when that option expires. So we understand the Coca-Cola strategy. I have Coke, I sell the Coke, I buy Pepsi. That's easy. In the cashless collar strategy, this is a little bit more complicated, so I'm going to go slow. Your client simultaneously purchases a put option, i.e. an insurance policy, and sells a call option. So the put option is the right for your client to put the stock to someone else, to sell it to someone else at a fixed price. And then on the call option side of things, you sell a call option. That's the right of somebody else to buy the stock away from you with an exercise date 31 days or more from the date of the cashless collar when you entered into it. So at the expiration date, the taxpayer tenders the lost stock to the counterparty. Conversely, if the stock stays inside the cashless collar's boundaries, the taxpayer would sell the stock. Now remember, if somebody recently received stock from an estate, that stock received a step-up in basis, and that could provide many loss harvesting opportunities. And we do want to make sure we're focused in on that. I think anybody that died in November, December, January, or February, this opportunity might be out there in a major league way. Now, finally, the final topic we should just touch upon is ISOs and NSOs. So incentive stock options, non-qualified stock options, two different things. And an ISO and NSO exercise will cause a recognition event. Simply put, the lower the fair market value at exercise, the lower the income recognized. So if my stock was at $50 a share back in January, and now it's at $25 a share, or $26 a share, I'm better to exercise at $26. If I was going to exercise this year anyway, and I was going to hold the stock, I might as well exercise at the $26. Now, that's the tax perspective. You keep in mind, now, if you weren't going to exercise for years, this is a non-event. You just ride it out, okay? From a financial standpoint, if you'd already made that sense, because once you jump out of these options, you lose your leverage. And what I like to do when I'm advising people on this, deepen the money options. Clearly, you look at those, and there's a big gain. Just when things are not deep in the money, but the strike price and the fair market value are roughly the same, there's not a lot of equity, you're a fool, generally, to exercise those options, because you're going to have a small gain, you're going to pay tax on that, and you're going to have to put that money to work for you. Where if you just left that leverage in place, a strike price of 50, when the current value is $50.50, why wouldn't you just leave that 50 cents in the game, so to speak, and enjoy all that leverage? So remember, when you're helping people with ISOs and NSOs, first look at it from a finance perspective. So we need to be 60 or 70% finance and 30 or 40% tax when we evaluate these things. Keep in mind, on the non-qualified options, you are going to get ordinary income to the extent of the difference between the compensation income and between the strike price and the fair market value. So if the stock were at $75 a share and your strike price was $5 a share, 75 minus 5 is 70, you'd have $70 of income per share. And that would all be plain vanilla ordinary income. That's why if the stock fell and you could exercise it and you were going to keep it anyway, you would reduce that immediate ordinary income. Now, the opposite holds true with ISOs. There's no ordinary income consequence of exercising. You just have an AMT preference item. And with the high AMT exemptions right now, it's probably not likely you're going to get thrown into the AMT. That's what you have to run. Okay, you have to run the numbers. How big are these numbers? And if these numbers are big enough, then maybe it pays to exercise when the stock is down. So we have covered a lot of ground today, and hopefully I've given you a couple of ideas on income tax planning in a volatile securities market. On behalf of the PFP section, this has been Bob Keebler. If you enjoyed this podcast, we highly encourage you to visit the PFP website and access additional information on tax planning in a volatile market. Stay tuned for Sarah Bradley, CPA, who will tell you how to find these valuable resources. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for sharing with our community of listeners. Want more information, resources, tools, and guidance on technical and practice management topics? Visit aicpa.org/PFP and check out the show notes for this episode as well. So if you're not already a member, think about joining the PFP section, which is designed to save you time, help you best serve your clients, and take your financial planning practice to the next level. You'll gain access to a robust selection of high-quality technical and practice management resources like guides, 24/7 access to an online learning library, client communication and education tools, up to 8 hours of free CPE, and more. Don't forget to leave us a review so we can continue bringing valuable and relevant content. And subscribe to our podcast channel so you don't miss an episode. Thanks for listening, and I look forward to next time.
This podcast is designed to provide illustrative information with respect to the subject matter covered and does not represent an official opinion or position of the AICPA or AICPA.org. It is provided with the understanding that the AICPA and AICPA.org are not engaged in offering legal, accounting, or other professional service. If such advice or expert assistance is required, the services of a competent professional person should be sought. The AICPA and AICPA.org make no representations, warranties, or guarantees as to, and assume no responsibility for, the content or application of the material contained herein, and especially disclaim all liability for any damages arising out of the use of, reference to, or reliance on such material.